Blog Talk Radio
presents a Blog Radio Show.
Welcome to Applause Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and I thank you so much for hanging out with us again. We've been having a great month. I'm just loving everybody that's been on the show, and I especially love hanging out with musicians, and we've got another one for you tonight. But before we go over and speak to our guest tonight, let me just do a quick thank you to our guest that was on the 21st, Georgiana Nupi Rodriguez. She is comedian Rosemarie, I almost said Sally Marie. Don't ask me where I got that. Rosemarie's daughter, and they recently celebrated her 100th birthday on her YouTube channel. It was a great centennial celebration for Rosemarie, and they released her new CD, which has never before been released. So you can find out more about that, or you can listen back at our show and find out more about it. And we had a great time. Thank you again, Nupi. What a great time we had. So tonight, I'm excited. I've been dying to speak to this gentleman for a while now, and can't wait to have him on the show. He is a singer, songwriter, composer, arranger, conductor, a pianist, just an all-around entertainer. Mr. Jay Asher is joining us tonight, and he's written for basically all the bigwigs over in the music industry. I mean, if you mention him, he's worked with them, specifically Whitney Houston, Donna Summer, and so many more. So without further ado, let's welcome to the show Mr. Jay Asher. Hey, Jay, how are you? Thanks so much for hanging out with me tonight. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Joanne.
Oh, I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to talk to you, Jay. How's the weather out there today?
Very nice today. Not too hot for a change, not too chilly for a change, although my wife would argue with me about the too chilly, but that's okay.
Oh, yeah, well, is your wife from the East Coast as well?
Yes, she is, but for some reason, you know, I joke with her that I married a Irish and French Catholic hardy girl from Boston and ended up with a Jewish lady from Miami, and I can't figure it out.
That's so funny. That's so funny. Because you know what? It kills me that people from the East Coast that move to the West Coast, when it's 60 or 70, they're freezing. It's like, come on. That's summer here, you know?
Yep.
That's summer here. Yeah, we've had a wet weekend. Oh, my God, I can't stand it. I hate when it's like this. It's okay for rain. We need it. I get it, right? You know, we get it. But it's been constant for 2 days. It has not stopped once. It's just been nonstop.
Well, yeah.
You don't miss that, I'm sure.
No, I do not. I don't miss I don't mind it, like you say, for a day or two, but I don't miss it day after day. But overall, you know, I've been in Los Angeles since 1972, and I still think of Boston as home.
Yeah, of course. Oh, well, here's a stupid question, just out of blue. As since you're on the West Coast and grew up on the East Coast, when it's Christmas time, do you feel a need that you have to come over this way?
Generally, when we do go back east, which is not that often, because quite frankly, most of the people we go to visit have passed away, unfortunately. Mm. You know, and a lot of my family had been living in Florida for years anyway. But we are actually going back this year, which I'm looking forward to.
Nice, nice. Because I always said to myself, if I ever lived in a warm climate state, you know, like LA, I think I would have to come back east for the holidays because it wouldn't feel like the holidays to me. But then again, I guess you get used to it, right?
Yeah, you get used to it. It's very different. I mean, it's just a whole different lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jay, let's talk about why we're really here.
Yeah, now, not to talk about the weather, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, I just hate when it rains like this. Ugh, I can't stand it. But anyway, you have, my goodness, you've been in the industry for, I don't even want to say the number of years, but you started,
since
dinosaurs
ruled the earth.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think you became professional, let's put the quotations, air quotes, professional since 72. Am I correct or no?
Actually, probably since 70, because I was a professional for a couple of years in Boston before I came to LA.
Yeah.
Even before that, for 7 years, I had been doing gigs with rock bands and playing in lounges. I mean, I started performing really when I was 11 years old with a children's troupe called the Novelettes. So, and, you know, I mean, I literally have been doing it all my life in one form or another.
Now, I was going to ask you that. How old were you when you picked up an instrument? What was your first instrument? Was it piano?
Well, first thing I did was sing. I started singing when I was about 5, but I picked up piano when I was 8. I started piano when I was 8 years old, which actually, by today's standards, a little bit late.
I guess, yeah. And now, was anyone in the family musicians as well, or what drove you to music?
Well, my dad was a drummer,
and he
was a professional drummer till he married my mother, and then a year later had me, and he didn't, you know, that wasn't a good lifestyle being on the road for a young wife and young child.
Right.
So at that point, he switched to just doing it on weekends and stuff. But my first gigs, a lot of them were with my father playing drums. And my father was
a good
drummer.
Wow. How cool is that you got to play with your dad? Did your dad get to see your success with your...
Yes. My dad died 2.5 years ago at the age of 98. And my mom died 4 months before that at the age of 92. So I was fortunate to have them for a long time. Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah, not many can say that, including myself.
No.
Including myself. Now, now you, I don't want to say you were you a balladeer your whole life, or no, you just loved everything?
I loved everything. I mean, my first love was people like Bobby Darin, you know.
Then
when the Beatles hit, of course, I was obsessed with British Invasion stuff. You know, it was all Beatles and Stones and Animals and Kinks and all that stuff. But then somewhere right around, I guess, 11th grade, I became aware of Burt Bacharach and Hal David because I was listening to Gene Pitney, who I loved, and Dionne Warwick. And I realized they were writing those songs. And that really, I think, is probably of all my influences, you know, Bert and Hal are the biggest influences on what I ended up doing.
Nice choices, though. Nice choices.
Yeah.
Right?
Periodically, I do a Burt Bacharach, Hal David tribute show out here with a band and with girl sings and stuff. And it's always a success, and I love doing it.
Great. Well, he's got a great catalog. My God. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You know.
And don't sleep on Hal. Those lyrics are every bit as important to those songs. I mean, you know, if you take away What's It All About Alfie, all you've got is da 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 da, and it doesn't mean very much without those lyrics.
Right. So now, Now, you were playing at clubs and everything, and so how did you get your first break on something in a film?
Well, it depends on how you define a break. I mean, my career has zigged and zagged. You know, every time I thought, okay, this is what I'm doing, this is where I'm having success, I'd kind of hit a wall and something else would open up, and I'd say, well, you know what? I think I could do that, and I would do it. Hmm. You know, I came out here thinking I was going to be a recording artist, a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
That was my goal. And I went around to publishers and brought my songs to them, and I did get some signed. I became a staff writer. I started writing with Paul Jabara, who wrote Last Dance and It's Raining Men, all that stuff. And Paul was just incredibly well-connected, particularly to the powerful gay people in the industry because he was a flamboyant gay. And he was really good at maneuvering through stuff. So in all honesty, most of the success I had as a songwriter was stuff that I wrote with Paul because he was just really good at promoting things. And so probably, you know, getting together with Paul was probably my biggest breakthrough, actually. Now, I hadn't even thought of it in that way, but I guess if you look at it, it really kind of was. And the other breakthrough was my manager was a guy named John Feldheimer. And John was handling a lot of actors like Dean Butler on Little House on the Prairie and Randy Oakes, who was on Chips, and a lot of people like that. And he took a job as vice president of New World Television and called me up one day and said, I've got good news for you and bad news. I said, what's the good news? He said, there's a TV series we're going to do here. And if the producers like a theme song you write for it, you can get to score the show. And that was Zorro. And Zorro was not a big hit here in America. It was on cable television at a time when cable television was maybe in 60% of households. And it was on the Family Channel, which wasn't on every cable channel. But it became really successful overseas. It was a much bigger deal in England and Spain and Germany and Italy and even Japan and stuff like that. And I did that for 4 years. And, you know, it was very successful. And even now it has a cult following here in America. There's a Facebook page called From Out of the Night, which is one of the lyrics of the theme song that Dennis Spiegel wrote the lyrics. And these people are just rabid. They watch it all the time. And whenever I come and I join the page, it's, oh, my God, you're a legend. And I say, yeah, the legend's eating a tuna fish sandwich, you know. But to them, you know, it's a big deal. And one of them did tell me a story that I'll share with you, because I think this is probably true for everything we do in life, not just what I do. I went there and I said, look, guys, I'm glad you liked the show. It was a nice little show, and I enjoyed doing the work. I think I did a decent job on it, but it's really no big deal. And a guy wrote me an email. He said, Jay, you don't understand. He said, when I was in high school, I was picked on mercilessly, and a lot of us were. He said, and I would come home really upset. And I'd turn on the TV, grab a snack, and there would be Zorro, and the theme song would come on about fighting for the poor and the oppressed. And for a half an hour, I could totally forget about my troubles. He said, I don't think I would have got through what I went through without that show. And that's when I realized that everything you do is like throwing a pebble into a pond. It has ripples that you don't foresee.
Yeah. Now, when you were growing up, were you a Zorro fan?
Yeah, the Disney Zorro, sure, yeah.
And there you were writing for the new Zorro. How cool was that?
Yeah, it was, because I wanted to pay homage to the composer of the series, who unfortunately his name escapes me now, but I wanted also to make it a little more modern, and the Family Channel very definitely wanted to. First version of the theme I did was very authentically kind of Spanish, you know, with a male singer and everything. And the head of the Family Channel says, we don't want this. We want something that sounds much more modern. You know, we don't want, I said, but it's set in, you know, set 150, 200 years ago. He'd say, I know, but that's not what we want for our audience. So I redid it and they loved it. And, you know, the theme is very popular. So I'm grateful I got that opportunity.
Absolutely. I want to share it with everybody for those who haven't heard it or have seen the show. It's very short. So let's play it real quick. This is the theme from Zorro that Jay composed. And I want to ask you, who's singing on this, Jay?
Her name was Kathy Campo, and she was Rosemary Clooney's niece.
Get out.
Yeah, and she had a terrible cold that day. We had to work like crazy to get it to sound like what it sounded like, through no fault of her own. She was not feeling very well, but she did a great job anyway.
Yeah, well, she doesn't sound like she has a cold at all in this. Then, folks, here you go. This is the theme from Zorro that Jay has composed for the newer version, not the Disney version. And, again, it's where can folks hear it again? They can see it? Oh, you said it's Tubi or something, I think it's on?
Yeah, it shows up there. And, it, you know, one of my frustrations is I think, you know, there's 80 episodes most of America never saw. I was really kind of shocked that they haven't been able to syndicate it, you know. They were releasing a DVD box set for a while, and then they stopped, and it goes for big money now on eBay.
Yeah.
I'm kind of shocked how much the DVD set goes for. But, yeah, it does show up on Tubi and different ones periodically.
All right. Well, let's play it. This is the theme from Zorro, composed by Jay Asher. Enjoy, folks.
When daggers are pointed at innocent hearts and muskets are ready to fire, where tyrants ride high and govern with fear as the forces of evil conspire, then from out of the night a hero must rise, the courage that evil a mask won't disguise, they turn to.
That's her on a bad day. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, she had some real good help from Patty Brooks and her daughter singing the backgrounds, who were wonderful singers. And Patty was an artist on Casablanca Records, who I became friendly with. And she and her daughter did the backgrounds. They did a wonderful job. And like I said, we had a talented engineer, and it came off very, very well. Once again, the lyrics were written by Dennis Spiegel, and I think he did a terrific lyric for it.
Absolutely. Now, after hearing that, I'm curious. Did you ever work with Laura Branigan?
I have not.
Mm.
I'm a fan, but I've never got to work with her.
Yeah, I got a little Laura Branigan out of that, her voice, her vocals, I guess.
Yeah,
maybe.
You know, I can absolutely hear that. I can absolutely hear that. Yeah.
Yeah, but that, if that's her on a bad day, wow. Oh, my goodness. She sounded fabulous. Unbelievable.
Yeah, she was a great singer. She really was.
Yeah, and then you also did the series, the Fame series, too. So how cool was that?
Well, actually, no. All I did is I had one song on Fame. I wrote a song with
Paul
Jabara.
On the movie?
No, this is on the TV series.
I thought it was a series.
Yeah, no. In fact, I'll tell you a quick funny story about Fame. The guy who wrote the lyrics for Fame is a guy named Dean Pitchford, who won an Academy Award and Grammy. And when I was a staff writer at Casablanca, we were writing songs together. And he played Fame for me before it came out, and he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "It's a terrific song." I said, "But I don't relate to that lyric at all." And he said, "You don't?" I said, "No, I don't care about being famous. I want the work. I'd like to make some money. I don't care if people forget who I am 10 minutes after I die, as long as my loved ones remember me and think I was a pretty good guy." And he couldn't believe that, because he very much wanted to be famous and all that. So, but no, I wrote this song with Paul Jabara called Beautiful Dreamer. And on one of the episodes of the Fame TV show, Valerie Landsberg and the guy who played Bruno, who played piano, they performed the song on the show. So that's the only involvement I had with Fame.
Yeah, but I mean, you've done other TV shows and movies too. I mean, Blame It on Rio, Fugitive Night. There's so many.
Yeah,
and
Blame It on Rio, I did all the arrangements of the song. Dennis Spiegel wrote the lyrics for the songs with the composer Ken Wanberg. And Ken was best known as John Williams' music editor, but he was also a very good composer. But he knew nothing really about contemporary pop music, so they hired me to do the arrangements.
Yeah. Now, you've, you've worked, I mean, written stuff for Donna Summers, Summer, my goodness, oh, man, don't tell me. Barbara Streisand, not Barbara Streisand. Oh my God, Whitney Donna
Houston.
Summer, Whitney Houston, Julio Iglesias, and
yeah.
more. I'm confusing your conducting days with the.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Yes, I apologize. Yes.
Yeah,
so now, how was
too,
it work?
Don't worry.
Yeah. How was it working with Whitney and Donna and Julio? And I mean, I obviously Whitney and well, I'm going to say Donna more.
Well, this is three very different experiences. Okay,
yeah.
I never even met Whitney Houston.
Oh, really?
Paul Jabbar and I, yeah, Paul Jabbar and I wrote a song called Eternal Love for the movie. And Dino De Laurentiis' assistant was in the studio with us. And, you know, what we didn't know at the time, and I don't even know why they bothered to do this because they footed the bill for the studio and everything, but they'd already made a deal with Lionel Richie to write the song.
Oh, Endless Love.
Which, of course, was a smash twice, right? So they made a good choice. But Paul and I knew that it was a good song, so we changed it from Endless Love to Eternal Love.
Hmm.
Paul had done several albums of his own. Paul was a really good singer and performer. He was originally in the cast of Hair, and he toured opening for Donna. And at this point, however, he'd been doing a lot of cocaine, and his voice was kind of shot. But he needed to do an album, so he made a deal with CBS that he would do an album called Paul Jabbar and Friends. And he enlisted the Weather Girls, who were friends of his, to do It's Raining Men, which he wrote with Paul Schaefer.
Paul Schaefer,
And Sissy Houston was a very well-known backup singer in town.
Yeah, sweet inspiration.
And she had a daughter named Whitney, who was, I think at the time, maybe 17 years old. And Paul said to me, I'm going to New York, and I'm going to record Eternal Love with Whitney. She's amazing singer. She's drop-dead gorgeous. She's going to be a huge star. And that was it, and he did. And the album, you know, didn't do all that much. And Al Teller, who is a legendary record executive, nonetheless decided not to sign Whitney to a contract. He didn't think she was going to break big. And, of course, Clive Davis reached a very different conclusion.
Right.
And, you know, and then Whitney became Whitney Houston. But I've actually never met Whitney. I never met Whitney before she passed. Donna, on the other hand, I was got to be with several times. We would have what Paul used to call our biannual Donna Summer Disappoint-a-thon. We would write a song for Donna. She would do a demo on it. She would sing the living crap out of it. It would be great. And then it wouldn't end up on the record because she'd always blame the producers and say, oh, look, I'm having trouble getting the songs I'm writing on the albums and everything.
Right.
So she did record a version of a song I wrote with Paul called Something's Missing in My Life. And Paul pieced it together with his version. And so that was my Donna Summer released recording. But I also have demos of her singing a couple of other songs, and she was amazing. You know, they describe the thing about listening to something and the hair standing up on the back of your neck. When I was with Donna playing piano and she was singing, I mean, that's what it felt like. That voice to me is one of, you know, my 10 favorite voices of all time.
Yeah.
And she was a really nice gal. She was from Boston as well. She was from Dorchester.
Yeah.
So she'd always say, oh, it's my friend from Boston. You know, so very nice lady.
Have you ever reached
Julio,
out to Bruce? I'm curious, Jay, have you ever reached out to Bruce and ask if you can
I know Bruce
release
Sedano.
That stuff?
Yeah, we're friends on Facebook.
Can you release that stuff?
He doesn't own the rights to it.
Ah.
And you know what? They're not finished.
What about you?
Anyway.
You
the
don't
demos.
Own the rights to it?
Well, I own one part of the publishing. You know, I own part of the copyright, but I don't own the masters, and there is no masters. Like I say, they never got past the demo stage. Mm. Nowadays, it would be possible to extract the vocal and do a full track and stuff like that, but I don't even know how we would get permission to do that. I imagine that would be up to Bruce, but I don't know. I've never really explored it, you know, and it's just one of those things.
That
the
would
Julio
be cool.
thing was the biggest success for us. Mm. Yeah, that song was on Julio's first English album, which sold about 5 million copies. And I'll tell you the story of this because this was fun. So Paul had met Julio, and you know, was introducing him all around Los Angeles to all these women and all these parties and all that stuff. And Julio liked a good time, you know. He definitely liked a good time. And he and Paul became friends. So Paul played him, I think it was Eternal Love. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I love it. I'm going to record it. But can you write me something new? I'd like something new. And Paul called me up. He said, you have to come over right away. He said, Julio says he's going to record it. He's not going to record it. He wants something written specifically for him. So we have to sit down and write a somewhat similar song. And I think it was me that came up with the idea of doing something along the lines of Two Sleepy People by Dawn's Early Light, Too Much in Love to Say Goodnight. I think that was my idea, but we sat down and we wrote it. And Julio was recording at Sunset Sound nearby, and Paul called him. And he said, Julio wants us to come over and play it for him. So we went right over to the studio, and Paul sang it, and I played piano. And Julio loved it, made us play it over and over again, said, you know, is it really for me? Blah, blah, blah. He just really made us feel like $1 million. My wife, Rosemary, said, I arrived home 15 minutes ahead of my car. I was so jacked up from it, you know. But then it was on the album and it was off the album. Everybody wanted to be on that album because they knew CBS was going to make sure that it broke. And they had the Willie Nelson duet, which they knew was going to be big. And one of Barry Manilow's lyricists said to me that I would sell Barry for a Julio Iglesias cover because he sells records all over the world. Yeah, not his finest moment. Yeah,
right.
At any rate, Paul politicked like crazy to get it on the album, and it did. And it was it didn't become a hit single. They didn't release it as a single because after the Willie Nelson duet, they released a duet with Diana Ross, and it was a hit, but not as big a hit. And then they released a solo song, just Julio, and it stiffed. And Julio was very upset and said, no more singles from the album. So, you know.
Nah, that's it.
Once again, you know, I've got a platinum record on the wall, and I made some very, very nice money from it. And it was, you know, a big, big break for us.
Very good. Now, Something's Missing in My Life that you wrote for Whitney has been done by several people, Karen Carpenter, Marsha Hines, I mean, so many other people.
Yeah.
And this
song has a checkered history. It's the very first song I ever wrote with Paul. I went there, and he was working on Last Dance, and, you know, he asked me to help him with Last Dance, which I did. But all I helped him with was a little bit with the structure. You know, Gary Amell used to tell people, well, you know, Jay wrote Last Dance with Paul. And I'd say, Gary, stop saying that. It's not true. Paul wrote the song. He had all the lyrics. He had all the melody. But Paul did it on his first album and did it quite well. And then Marsha Hines, who was the biggest recording artist in Australia and New Zealand, had a big hit there. And the irony of it is she couldn't even get her records released in the U.S. It was considered a provincial market at that time. And they couldn't even get her a record deal in America, which is too bad. She did a nice job of it. And then Stephanie Mills. Stephanie Mills did Eternal Love. Excuse me.
A bunch of people did it.
Some really bad versions and some good versions. The one that was a heartbreak was the Karen Carpenter one because it was supposed to be on her solo album that Phil Ramone was producing.
Yep.
And, you know, I was very excited because I was a huge Karen Carpenter fan.
Yeah.
And so we're waiting, and I'm in the publisher's office, Gary Lamell's office, and he had an assistant named Sandy Beach. And I said, Sandy, what's going on with Karen and Something's Missing? She said, let me call Phil Ramone. So she picks up the phone, she calls Phil, and I hear her say, oh, Phil, how could you? She hangs up and she said, yeah, they've cut it from the album. And then, of course, they decided to cut the whole album.
I was going to say, the whole album was cut. Yeah,
Richard didn't like it.
Yeah.
And Karen had passed by then. And then Richard did decide to release it, but only certain cuts, and ours didn't make the cut for whatever reason. I don't know. But I was at a songwriter conference, and there's Phil Ramone, and there's a Q&A at the end. And I raised my hand. I said, Phil, you recorded a song I wrote with Karen Carpenter. I've never got to hear it. And he says, what was the song? And I said, something's missing in my life. He goes, oh, what a song. He said, call my office. I'll see that you get a copy. And, of course, got big applause, you know. Well, I nagged them for 4 or 5 months. And finally they said, there's nothing to give you. He never did a finished mix. He'd have to go in the studio and pull the tapes, everything. He's not going to do it. So I reconciled myself to the fact that I was never going to hear it.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, about 4 years ago, there it is on YouTube. And somebody put a video to it. And to this day, I can't tell you how that got released, whether some second engineer had a copy and decided to put it out. But there it is on YouTube. And it isn't totally finished. But you, to me, you hear right away how much that lyric rang true to her real life.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the problem. Maybe Richard thought it was a little too close to the truth.
I was going to say that. Maybe they thought it was a little too close to home for at the time.
I think maybe. Maybe not. Maybe Richard just didn't care for it. But to me, had she completed it and released it, it would have been the best version of the song.
Mm, I'll have to check it out. You know, we had
it's on YouTube.
Yeah, I had on the other night, I had a Carpenters historian, Chris May, on, and he's friends with Richard. He's very close with Richard, and we actually talked about why that disco, if you want to call it a disco album, her solo project, I'll call it, was never released. And he said because some of the songs just were too high pitched for her voice, and I don't know, maybe he didn't think that people were ready for that change of her vocal style. I don't know, but I'd love to hear it. It's supposedly out there somewhere, and I'd love to hear it.
Well, they did release an album. They did finally release an album. But like I said, mine unfortunately didn't make the cut.
Yeah. Well, I want to share that with everybody now, too. Let's share that. That's called Something's Missing in My Life, right? And
right.
But this is Donna's version, unfortunately. I had to get it where I got it. It's part of a movie. And I have to ask, is it part of Thank God It's Friday?
No, I don't think so. No, her version came out after the version she did with Paul came out after that.
All right. So then maybe this is just a music video. It looked like a movie to me. So, but we're going to hear some talking before the song actually plays. So this is Something Missing in My Life, written by, of course, Jay, and performed by Donna Summer.
You are nuts, lady. Don't you understand? This is going out live. There are millions of people listening to my golden tones. I ain't going to blow it. This ain't amateur night.
Listen, Mr. Big Shot DJ. I ain't no amateur. I paid my dues. All I'm asking for is a chance.
Lady, please. Hey, Bear!
All right. I'll go.
Would you take her away from me? Would you take her out of here?
If you're alone. You understand?
You know, could you imagine if she was still with us?
If you find yourself staring at walls of the else, she improvised that in the studio. That was her improvising. She was so brilliant.
Yeah.
She was just
and I love that. It's like I'm not an amateur. No kidding, Donna.
Yeah. I think you're right, though.
What
I think
a boy.
That was from Thank God It's Friday. I think somebody put that in there, you know, as a linkage.
Yeah, I think it is, too. I wasn't sure because it looked like it when I was watching it. And that's the only version I could find.
Yeah,
that was the only version I could find. So, but, yeah, what a boy. So, Donna, we miss you. Oh, boy. What a voice. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And, like I said,
she was a very nice person. She really was.
Yeah. And Paul wrote that with you.
Yeah. It's the first song we wrote together.
Now, you guys out there who don't know, Paul is also, he was an actor and a songwriter, and he co-wrote so many of the great disco songs. Last Dance, of course, that we mentioned earlier. No More Tears. Oh, another fabulous tune. And, of course, It's Raining Men, which Jay mentioned earlier. But, oh, my God.
Yeah. Paul was a disco pioneer. When I got together with him, I knew nothing about disco. And
I was
going to
say, did you ever think you'd be working with disco? I mean, I know you love all kinds of music, but disco?
Well, disco at that point was kind of new, and I didn't really know much about it. All I knew about Donna was Love to Love You, Baby.
Right.
And, you know, disco, it was just really taking off. Paul was undeniably a pioneer in disco in America. He absolutely was. And he saw this coming. Yeah. And as you said, he was an actor primarily and a musical theater performer. And the songwriting he did because, you know, he had the opportunity to do it. But it was always his dream to be Al Pacino more than it was to be, you know, a songwriter.
Right, right. Well, he did play a pivotal role in the disco invasion for sure.
Yeah, he did. No doubt about it. And Paul was crazy talented. He was just crazy, period. But he was crazy talented. It was always great fun writing with Paul. We would laugh and laugh.
When was the last time you wrote with him? I mean, obviously he was ill and were you close
with
him?
About a month before his death.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we weren't close because part of the reason Paul liked to write with me was I was different from his other collaborators. Mm. The guys he wrote with, like Bruce Roberts and Bob Esty, were also gay, and they also wanted to be celebrities. They wanted to be in the spotlight, and they all wanted to be seen as hip. It was very important to them to be seen as hip. Paul always told me how corny I was. And I think what he liked writing about me is that he could release his corny side because, when truth be told, he was way cornier than me.
Right.
He did a version of Beautiful Dreamer, and it's Paul in Wonderland with harp glissandos and strings and all this stuff that is way more schmaltzy than any version I ever would have done with him.
Oh, that's funny.
And when we were finished writing, I wasn't competing with him. I went home to my wife. And, you know, so believe it or not, we wrote together for 15 years, and I don't think I even have a single picture of us together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that's
odd. It just, it is. And it's not that we weren't ever together outside of when we were writing.
No, we weren't
social friends. We had very different lifestyles, and we traveled in very different circles.
Right. And again, I think he enjoyed working with you because you weren't looking for the fanfare. You were just looking to get a gig and write and work.
Right. Right.
Right.
And he could write songs with me that were different from what he wrote with everybody else. I mean, he probably never would have written It's Raining Men with me, although we did write a song called Disco Divorce. That's part of the disco trilogy. But on the other hand, songs like Beautiful Dreamer, I don't believe he would have written Beautiful Dreamer with any of his other collaborators. Their minds just musically didn't work that way. And we wrote a song that he did with Lita Galloway on Paul Gerard and Friends called What's Become of Love.
Mm-hmm.
And at the risk of sounding like self-aggrandizing, which I don't tend to do, if anything, my wife says I tend to undersell myself. but the kind of chords and harmonies and stuff like that are just way more sophisticated than what Motive's songs are. And he just probably wouldn't have written that song with anybody but me.
Right. Now, obviously, the music industry has done a it's totally changed now. It's totally changed now. So how are you fitting in with today's music? And I believe you're teaching somewhere as well, are you?
Well, my career took kind of a stunning turn that I never saw coming. In 1990, when I got hired to do Zorro, I had two choices. I could go to Europe and record a big orchestra, or I could record a small orchestra in Los Angeles, buy a computer with synthesizers and samplers and do the composing on that, and then mix together the real orchestra with the synthesizers and samplers. This was what we now call a hybrid score, and now it's, you know, done probably a 9 out of every 10 pictures. But in those days, this was kind of a new thing, and I thought, I'm going to hate this, and I'm going to suck at it, because I'm not a math science guy. I'm a book reader and a history guy, but
musician.
I think this is going to be important. And so I got the computer and with a little help started to learn it, and I got to be, to my shock, kind of an expert on it, to the point where this one program that I use, Logic Pro, I've written 4 books on it. I've been the consultant to people like Alex Van Halen and Steve Picaro of Toto, and a lot of, you know, successful people helping them with it. And I do teach it at the Songwriting School of Los Angeles as well. And that's a whole side thing that came to my career that I just never saw coming.
Yeah.
But it became an important part of what I did. But I still continued to do music for Blu-rays and DVDs. There were a lot of Little House on the Prairie retrospectives. And one of the stars who played Almanzo, Dean Butler, was producing all these. And because I had been his musical director, he hired me to do the music for them. And then I've done a bunch for Lionsgate because my manager, John Feltheimer, the one who was at New World, became CEO of Lionsgate. And he introduced me to a guy there that was doing special material for Blu-ray for DVDs, like the Beach Boys biopic, Love and Mercy, and Conan the Barbarian, the remake, and all that stuff. So I started doing special material, you know, just all on the computer using samples and stuff, which I became very adept with. And that's something that became part of my career, too.
Well, since you know that so well, why don't you find a niche in what's going on today? Go under a pseudonym or something and put something out.
You know, here's what happened. For many years, I stopped writing songs. I didn't see the point. I said, this kind of songs I like to write, you know, that's not what you hear on the radio. Mm. And all the publishers and A&R people I used to see are either retired or dead. And I just didn't see the point. And then 5 or 6 years ago, I decided it's time for me to do what I came to L.A. to do, which is to make an album. That's what I thought I came here to do, and I can do it all by myself with a couple other musicians, and I did. And I wrote – they were all songs I'd written with various people like Harriet Schock and Kathy Wakefield and Enoch Anderson, you know, great lyricists. And I said, but I'm going to write one new one, and I did. And that got my juices going. And so now I'm writing a whole bunch of songs, and I can do really good-sounding versions of them. And then I go around L.A. and I perform them. And, you know, it's not making me any money. It's not. But you know what? I realized I had cut my nose off to spite my face, because if I'm not writing songs and performing them, I don't feel like I'm truly me. That's who I am. It's what I do. And I need to do it, even if I never make another dime.
Yeah, well, when you release your new music, come back. Let's let everybody know.
I'll send you the links. I've got a SoundCloud page that's got all the newest stuff. And my album is called Honestly. It's on Bandcamp and Apple Music and all the usual places. It's sold tens of copies. And, you know, but I'm really glad I did it. Because this is like
you on vocals? Is it you on vocals?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we got to check it out. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, singing is what I did first. You know,
right.
That's what I
right.
did first.
Right. Now, conducting, you're also you're a music conductor for some pretty large acts too. I mean, my God, you what did you do for Carol Burnett? Was that recent or way back?
No, this is way back. And all that happened there was I got hired to be the rehearsal piano, the rehearsal pianist for Neil Diamond's TV special. Mm. And Carol was one of the guests. And she was great, and she knew Paul Jabara. So, but basically, I was there to play piano for rehearsal for Neil Diamond. And I was a massive Neil Diamond fan, still am.
Yeah,
one of the
best
singer-songwriters ever.
Never.
But it was not the happiest experience, and I'll tell you a little story.
Oh,
and I
no,
think,
what?
Well, I think he felt very stressed because, you know, he only ever did one TV special, and he only ever did one film, The Jazz Singer, which was a huge hit. And I don't think he enjoyed doing either. He was nervous, and he was pacing and chain-smoking, and so I think he was just very stressed. So came time to rehearse a medley of his hits. And I've got the charts there in front of me. And we're going along, and it's all going fine till we get to his song, Forever in Blue Jeans. Do you know the song?
Mm-hmm. Yep, Forever
Money
in Blue
talks.
Jeans.
Yep. Don't walk. As long as I can have you here with me, I'd much rather be forever in blue jeans. Yeah,
yep,
you know.
Yep.
So I'm reading the music, and I'm playing oompa, 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 which is what the music is written. He says, stop. I said, what? Playing it wrong. He says, play it again. I play it again. Stop. You're still playing it wrong. I said, Neil, that's what's written here on the chart. And I said, and respectfully, I know your record. I'm not playing it wrong. And he says, well, I wrote the damn thing, and I'm telling you, you're playing it wrong. Well, I don't know what to do at this point. But fortunately, his musical director, Tom Hensley, overhears it. And he comes over and he says, what's the problem? And Neil says, he's playing it wrong and he won't admit it. Tom says to me, play it, Jay. And I play it. Tom turns to Neil. He says, Neil, Jay isn't playing it wrong. You're used to hearing it on guitar, not piano. It sounds different on guitar. And Neil goes, oh. That's it. No,
wow.
I'm sorry. No, nothing. Oh.
No, nothing. Yeah.
Nothing. But once again, I think he was just feeling really pressured and stressed out. I didn't take it personally, and it didn't cause me to stop loving his music. And
you didn't lose the gig. And you didn't lose the gig.
I didn't lose the gig because I was doing the gig.
Right.
I was
playing
it correctly.
That's right. Oh, my goodness. And Minnie Riperton, that must have been cool to work with her.
Yeah, I only got to do that one day. What a voice. You know, I was filling in for another guy, Randy Waldman, who's a wonderful pianist and musical director, and he had a conflict, and he asked me to fill in at the rehearsal for her and play for her, and it was great, you know.
Yeah,
the one
experience.
I did the most musical director work for was for about 6 years. I did for Rosalind Kine, who's Barbara Streisand's half-sister.
Yeah, she's been on the
and
show, actually. Yeah.
Oh, has she? Yeah. Yeah. Rosie was great. We had a really great time together. We did a bunch of telethons and stuff together. She did some of my songs in her act, songs that I wrote. And, we had a really nice run. Then she eventually became friends with Bud Cort, who's, you know, famous from Harold and Maude. And Bud convinced her that she shouldn't be doing contemporary pop music. She should be doing the Great American Songbook. And I did one show where I did the arrangements and conducted for her. But it wasn't music I had that same passion about. And so she eventually moved on to a musical director who did have that passion. But we had about 5 or 6 years together, and we're still friends. We still talk periodically and stuff. And, you know, Rosie's great.
Yeah, she's a lovely, lovely, lovely woman. We had a wonderful time.
Yeah, she really is.
Yeah.
Strong
I should have her
conscience, too.
Yeah, I should have her back on, actually. It's been a while. I'm sure she's got some other stuff
great.
That she could talk about. Now, let me ask you this. Now, a lot of the greats are no longer with us. We have very few that are with us. Who would be your, dream to work with?
Oh, you mean as a musical director?
No, as a writing a song for.
Oh,
just
writing a
any,
song
any,
for.
In any capacity.
Jeez. That's a little, I'm trying to
dead
think
or
now.
Alive.
Oh, dead or alive, now we're getting somewhere. Well, any songwriter you ever ask will tell you that they would have loved to have had something done by Ray Charles. I mean, you know, that's for a songwriter. Most people would say probably Barbara Streisand, too, and she actually went into the studio and took a pass at Something's Missing at one point and then decided that the whole album was going to be about water. It was called Wet. And so when she came in to see Rosalind, she came in with Marvin Hamlisch. And at that point, all I knew was that she was working on it. So I said, nice to meet you, Miss Streisand. Looking forward to hearing, you know, what you do with Something's Missing. And she said, oh, I'm afraid it won't be on this album because the album is all about water. It's all wet. And there's a line in the song, got my house, got my fancy car. I turned to my wife. I said, there goes our house. There goes our fancy car. So, sure, she would have been a great one. But to be honest with you, I'd have just been happy if Karen had released that thing and finished it. And if Donna had released and finished those, I would have been happy with any of those. I mean, you know, it's some of my favorite singers.
It's like the elusive, the one that got away, that song. It's like so many opportunities it had, and it just never got its opportunity. Wow. And it's such a great song, too. Oh,
yeah.
My goodness. Well, let me ask you this, Jay. If folks wanted to find out more about you or get honestly and all that, where can they reach out to you?
Well, my website is www.jayasher.com, surprisingly.
Yep.
And, you know, you can see all the links and stuff there. And, you know, my email is there. If they want to email me, I'm very open to that. You know, I really, at this point, I just, I reflect back. And for many years, I think, like most of us, I would look at what didn't happen. And it's only recently that I've started to accept that, all right, there are things that were disappointments that, you know, I thought was going to take me to the very next level. And it didn't happen. But look at all the stuff I've got to do. A young Jay Asher today, would not get to do a tenth of what I've got to do because it's a different era and most of the world that I came up in doesn't exist. Even in the beginning, when I came to L.A., I could play in a nightclub 5 or 6 nights a week with a band that I put together, and I didn't get rich doing it, but I would get paid every night to play and sing and get better and better and better and learn how to work with an audience and to do all that. And that kind of work just doesn't exist anymore. And I learned so much. Anytime I was offered a job as a piano player or as a composer that was something I hadn't done before, I would do it because I'd say, someday I may want that crayon in my crayon box. I want to know how to do that. When I took the job with Bobby Gentry and Jim Stafford playing piano for them, I was the only guy in the band who wasn't a country player. But I got the job because I could read music and because Bobby liked the way I played and sang. And I took it because I wanted that experience. I wanted to know what it was like to play that kind of music with a, you know, with a big band and stuff in Vegas. And it was a wonderful experience for me.
Nice. Well, now let's
young people wouldn't get to do it.
Yeah. Well, no, not many, not many at all. So what's upcoming for Jay? Are you playing out soon or you're out there now or you're conducting?
There's a place out here called Molly Malone's Pub that's pretty well known. I'm doing a set there Thursday. And then once a month, usually there's this Tarzana Community and Cultural Center where they have a whole bunch of singer-songwriters doing a couple of songs there. Saturday night, they're hosting a tribute to the drummer for Three Dog Night, Floyd Sneed, who was an amazing drummer. And a bunch of musicians who played with different people that played with Floyd are all doing, and I'm going to do a couple of numbers like Old Fashioned Love Song. And so anytime I get the opportunity to get out and play, and I do a Burt Bacharach, Hal David tribute show periodically. And I did a show for a benefit that was all about American Bandstand teenage idols, and I had Dean Butler and Karen Richmond from the New Gidget doing songs. We did all these early 60s songs.
Oh, fun.
And we just had a wonderful time, and it was very well received. So at this point, you know, I do whatever I see the opportunity to do because I love doing all of it. I love being on a stage performing, but I also love being behind the scenes, doing the musical directing and the arranging when that happens. I love being in the studio when that happens. I love helping people with Logic Pro when that happens. I just enjoy it all, and I'm just grateful that I still at least am healthy and I get the opportunity to do some of this stuff.
Jay, you've had an amazing life and career, and it surely isn't over yet by any means. You've got a long way to go, my friend, and can't wait to hear what's next. I would love to hear you. It's a shame you're out in L.A. I won't be able to check you out there. You ever see yourself coming over to the East Coast, New York at all?
I'd love to, but here's the thing.
Well, other than Thanksgiving.
I did explore trying to perform in places back east. Here's the thing. If you find a venue that is open to doing it, you have to guarantee you can draw X amount of people. And if you can't, you have to make up the difference in the ticket prices. And they can cancel you at the last minute. So let's face it. I mean, while I've had some success, I'm not James Taylor. It's not like people see my name on a marquee in New York and say, oh, I got to go see Jay Asher. So it just isn't doable. But listen, if you ever run across a situation where there's an opportunity, you know, have keyboard, we'll travel. I'd love to do it.
Oh, I'd love to see you, too. I'd love to see you. Oh, my
you
goodness.
You know, I can put on a pretty good show.
I'm more than 1,000,000% positive that you do. So my loss.
A very long time.
Yes, my loss.
Thank you.
My loss that I can't see you. But Jay, thank you so much for hanging out with me tonight. It was a pleasure speaking with you. I've been looking forward to this for weeks since we spoke and said, you know, let's do it. And I'm so glad we did. Thank you so much. And please, please, please come back anytime. And folks, go check out his new music, honestly, at jayasher.com, and it's all over the place anywhere online. And also, you could see him out in California. Do you have your dates are on your website, I guess, right?
No, you know, I don't tend to do that. I probably should, shouldn't I?
Yeah, you should.
I've gotten kind of lazy about my website. I have to be honest. I put it out there, and I've gotten kind of lazy about it.
Well, I expect anybody to come and see you if they don't know where you are.
Well, you know, I've kind of got it's not a big following, but I've got a following here that come out to see
me. Yeah, so
let's
get a bigger following by saying where we'll be and, you know,
All right, sounds like a plan. The thing is in L.A., and, you know, it's amazing how many talented people out here trying to get people to come out. On any given week, you know, there's a whole bunch of people I know, singer-songwriters, and they're all terrific, and they're all scrambling to get people to come out. And, you know, that's the nature of this town, you know.
Yep. Oh, my goodness. Well, Jay, thank you again. Again, a pleasure. As a musician, it's an honor. Thank you so much. I can't even say thank you enough. And, again, I wish I could see you myself out there, but I'm not out there. So if you ever come to the East
Coast,
let me know.
We'll come out for a
visit.
It's a good place to come visit.
Yeah, I know. I can't get away right now. I wish. You kidding me?
Yeah.
I'm so entangled with so much stuff right now. I can barely go to the bathroom, put it that way. How busy it is. But anyway, thank you so much, Jay. It was a pleasure. I have to get in the couple announcements before I go, so I need to say goodnight and thank you again. And everybody, Mr. Jay Asher, check out Honestly at www.jayasher.com and all his other stuff out there, and hopefully some gig dates will be up there soon. We don't know. We're working on that.
Thank you, Joanne.
Oh, thank you, Jay. Take care. It was a pleasure. Everybody, bye. Jay Asher. Thank you, Jay. Bye-bye. All right, folks.
Bye-bye.
Well, listen, that will be our last show till tonight is our last show for the month of September. We'll be back on October 8th. Oh, look who's coming back on October 8th. Our good friend, Michelle. Everybody loves Michelle. She's going to do her psychic readings for you guys. You love her. The 12th, we've got Donnell Danigan from the Hollywood Museum. We're not going to have a full month this month with shows. It's just been a lot going on, and there's a lot of birthdays too that I have to be available for, family functions and some work functions that I need to take care of. So we are going to get in what we can, but we will be back on the 8th of October with Michelle Wilkins Palmieri. She normally goes by Palmieri. I don't know why I use the middle name. Michelle Palmieri, she'll be back doing her free readings for you guys because you love her so much. I love her that she does this for me and for you guys, the fact that she comes and hangs out. So that's pretty cool. And then, check our calendar next week. It should be updated. So right now we are going to close out with one of Jay's songs that we didn't play. And that, which one didn't we play? I had them written down here. We're going to end with, we'll do Eternal Love. And Jay wrote this, Whitney did it, and several other people, Karen Carpenter, and as we mentioned, a few other folks. So, but this is Whitney Houston's version, and it is Eternal Love. And it was supposed to be in Endless Love, the movie, but the song that took the score for that was Lionel Richie, Endless Love. But this is Eternal Love, Jay Asher, and Paul Jabara. And thank you again very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Jay Asher, for hanging out with me tonight. I appreciate it so much. Have a good night, everybody. Have a great week. Take care. We'll see you October 8th. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Nobody loves you like I do. It's just not fair. You can't keep me away, 'cause I won't give you up. I'm gonna get you back today, my only dream, my one reality, my pledge to you.